Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. My name is Oren McIntyre. So before we dive into the stream today, I just want to let you know my book, my first book, is coming out here in a little bit and it's already available for pre-order. The response has been amazing. I just posted about it yesterday and it's already sitting in number one on one of the Amazon hot new books list. So the response has been wild. I know a number of you guys have been watching this channel since it had just a few hundred subs. I recognize so many of you who have been supporting my work, reading my work over at my Substack on the Total State when I was working on the different book chapters and everything there. It's been a long road. This has been an amazing ride. I can't even really explain how all of this happened, but it's been incredible. And the support that the audience has given me, the support that you guys have given me, the way you come by, you interact, you're super chatting, you're talking in the comments while we live stream and everything, all the different people I've interviewed, all the different people who have helped me along the way, it's just been an incredible journey. And I'm just blown away by the opportunity, the fact that I get to do this for a living now. It's wild. And so I just want to say thank you first to everybody, who's just been in the audience, who's been supporting me, who's been along for this ride. It's been incredible. And I also want to say just thank you to everybody who's already pre-ordered this book. It's amazing. And I just wanted to say it's out now for pre-order. I've got a link down below in the description if you want to go ahead and do so. It's going to be a little while that everything's going to print now. But final copies are in, all the gears are in motion. So if you want to do that, the link to do that is down below. But I appreciate your support and it's been amazing. So that said, I'm not here today to talk about my book. I'm here to talk to you guys about another book that I read this year. It was on my suggested reading list for 2023. I do one of these suggested reading lists at the end of every year to give you an idea of kind of what I've been looking at, what's been impacting my thought, the way that I've looked at the world, and suggest some things that you might want to check out if you want to understand where some of my insights have been coming from. And one book that I read was The Return of the Strong Gods by a guy named R.R. Reno. He's an author and he's the editor over at First Things Magazine. Many of you guys are probably familiar with First Things. It's a famous Catholic publication. They do a lot of interesting work. They have a lot of interesting writers on there. Yes, there's traditional Catholics, but they also have even anons like Lomez, who wrote an amazing piece about the Longhouse over there. Got a lot of people worked up. They couldn't believe that a Catholic magazine had run that piece, but it was a very good piece. And Lomez is a very thoughtful guy. And so I'm glad to see that they are willing to branch out and publish interesting people on that website. But R.R. Reno is the manager or the editor over there. And he wrote this book, Return of the Strong Gods. And it's a very interesting book. It goes some very interesting places. I don't think it gives a satisfying conclusion. We'll talk about that as we talk about the book. But it sets a really powerful frame that I think is worth thinking about as we look at the year ahead. Because I think if there's one thing that's going to be true about the year ahead, it's that we're going to see the return of the strong gods. The beginning of that has already been set in motion. And I think that those forces are going to become more and more powerful in our world, in our culture, in our politics, everything around us. So I want to talk about this book because I think it has some good insights. It has maybe some unsatisfying conclusions, and I want to talk about those and how we can look at those differently. So, looking at The Return of the Strong Gods, what's he talking about? Well, Reno starts the book talking about the post-war consensus, post-World War II consensus. And he says, after this time of strong men, totalitarian governing bodies, there is this response, especially among Western liberal democracies, to try to avoid anything that could return us to the kind of mid-century German mindset. We didn't want to be in a place where authoritarian regimes would rise up. Now, this is interesting because, of course, the Soviet Union was one of these regimes, and it gave birth to many other communist dictatorships inside its sphere of control. But particularly in the West, we were looking to avoid a return to this kind of leadership. And so in order to do that, we saw our leaders invest pretty heavily in the ideas of the open society, Karl Popper's open society. We needed to get rid of hard boundaries, grounded identities, the kind of things that gave us an idea of transcendent truth, that it stirred men's passions and men's loyalties, the kinds of things that build authority and hierarchies. This is the kind of stuff that they were worried about. And so they wanted to make sure that we could kind of banish those feelings. We could put them in the closet. We could avoid any connections that would drive people in this manner. There's a real hesitancy to embrace any of those. In fact, it wasn't just a hesitancy. It was a specific effort to try to dissolve those kind of things, to put the strong gods in a closet and to usher in weaker ties that would allow us to operate and trade and have a multicultural society, have an open society where anyone could be involved, anyone could kind of plug themselves in. Nothing that drew any hard lines, any hard boundaries. And so we saw the ushering in of these weak gods, these kind of loose ideologies that were meant to bind people together in a way that still allowed society to function, but didn't create anything that was too exclusionary. And so we see the ideas again of people like Karl Popper, and we also see a lot of stuff from guys like Adorno with the authoritarian personality. And the entire theme of the authoritarian personality is basically like authority, having any kind of hierarchy, any kind of traditional connections to things like, say, Christianity or family or community. Those are all terrible. Those are bad authoritarian tendencies. And so instead, you know, we have to dissolve those kinds of things. And he spends a good amount of time, Reno does, on kind of explaining the open society, probably too much time. The book kind of repeats itself a good bit. He takes a look at it from many different angles. That's useful. There's a lot of value in that because it's probably a phenomenon that's not talked about enough in our society and in our history, even in the conservative or right-wing community. But it's something that definitely took place. However, he sits on that subject for perhaps too long, maybe because moving on would mean addressing some things that are uncomfortable. We'll talk about that in a second. But he doesn't just attack the left on this. He doesn't just look on the leftist version of this. He also looks at kind of the libertarian right or right-wing kind of conservative version of this. He takes aim at people like Friedrich Hayek and kind of the need to use economics as the way to introduce weak gods. You know, economics will kind of define everything. That's what will bind us together. These loose contractual consensual relationships. This, guys, is why libertarianism is wrong. Me and Dave Smith had to go through this last time. I still don't think Dave is convinced, but we'll get him there. That these purely consensual relationships are insufficient to bind a community together. These non-chosen bonds are actually the kinds of things that truly create civilization, whether we like them or not. That's a scary thing for a lot of people to say, but it is the truth. But this was kind of the focus on this from the right. He also says he talks about Bill Buckley and the problems of Bill Buckley and the National Review crowd and kind of why this version of conservatism, which again banished many of those old forms of right-wing thought and ushered in much more of this liberal conservatism, and that this was kind of going to be the way forward. We don't want any of this collectivism, right? You hear that from a lot of people today. It's all about individualism versus collectivism. That's not correct. If you're a right-wing individualist, then you might need to think a little more about the right-wing tradition. You might need to read something that was printed before the post-war consensus, before 1945, to get a better understanding of historical conservative or traditional thought. Because if that's your understanding of it, then you're probably not well versed in what kind of came before that moment. So he looks at both left and right and says, there was a birth of both of these ideologies, an ideological commitment rather than commitment to older things, stronger gods. We have these weaker gods that came in and attempted to kind of hold society together. And I think this is really interesting because I don't know if he knows this. I mean, Reno seems a relatively well-read guy, so maybe he's read Carl Schmitt, maybe he hasn't. But if he has it, he should, because his arguments mirror a lot of what Carl Schmitt says in Concept of the Political when he talks about the fact that the left, that liberalism in general, rather not just the left, but also what we would think of as classical liberalism today, has attempted to put the friend-enemy distinction in the closet. He talks about it much more in the political sense. Reno talks about it more in the metaphysical and spiritual sense. They're both right. They're both talking about the same phenomenon, that modernity, especially the liberalism that emerges out of the Enlightenment, is attempting to put away these key aspects of conflict, of identity, of loyalty, of authority, of hierarchy, of meaning and belonging, wants to put them all away and just kind of reduce us to this bare minimum version of morality and identity that allows us to have maximum openness, that which means we can have maximum market transactions, we can have the best kind of trade, this is where multiculturalism comes from, is this ability to no longer be bound to what are these concentric circles of identity that every person used to sit into. Again, I recently had Jonathan Peugeot on, and he talked about in our discussion, those nested identities that really are supposed to make us all up, and how desperately the modern world has attempted to shred those in an attempt to remove all conflict, because as Reno acknowledges and Schmitt acknowledges and Peugeot acknowledges and all the classical liberals and progressives who are worried about these identities acknowledge rightly, is that these identities are the core of conflict. The truth is that these identities do create conflict and they do create violence. That is just a truth, because when you no longer have the ability to pretend that you can kind of resolve these identities, you can resolve these metaphysical questions through kind of shared conversation, then often we get these clashes of civilizations. I'm going to talk about that too in a second. That's something that I've also been reading a lot about with Sam Huntington. So Reno says that, you know, he's worried about these. So this is kind of where Reno, I think, falls a little short. You know, he acknowledges, okay, that these strong gods are coming back. And he says, look, there's nothing we can do about the strong gods returning. He specifically mentions nationalism and populism. This is kind of his attempt to explain the rise of Donald Trump and the sweeping, nationalism that's coming through many of these countries. We see the election of stronger leaders in many of these areas. We see things like Brexit coming through. Some of them fail to launch. I mean, Trump in many ways failed to launch certain aspects of American nationalism returning. However, he says these things are not going away. And our leaders have worked very hard to keep them in the closet. They worked very hard to suppress them. We've used all kinds of mean names for the kind of people who would acknowledge any of these strong gods. But whether we like it or not, the strong gods are coming back. And so for Reno, he says, look, I don't like this because I kind of believe in the Enlightenment. I believe in liberalism. Like, I want to hold on to many of these aspects of classical liberalism. But these are coming back whether we like it or not. And so we need to think about what that means. I acknowledge, I appreciate him at least being honest about that aspect of reality, because that is hard enough in itself to kind of agree with, right? That for someone who's dedicated to many of these ideas and understands how dangerous it is to touch any of these wires. I mean, you can feel that these wires are live. Just talking about these things, just acknowledging these things, thinking about them, you know that these are dangerous subjects, right? And so he acknowledges the fact that, look, these things are coming back. And so if we don't talk about them, if we don't acknowledge these forces, if, you know, the attempts of our leaders to suppress them are going to fail, and their attempts are going to be ugly, and they're ultimately going to fail. And if no one who has a positive vision for what to do with these metaphysical truths, these transcendent and powerful forces, if no one who has a positive vision harnesses these and guides them in a positive direction, they will come in terrible and ugly forms, and they will do terrible and ugly things. And I think he's right about that. I think that is something that the right needs to think a lot about. I know we're never going to get the Republicans to deal with this. I know the GOP is never going to deal with this, but it's something that those of us who are on the right and attempting to form something new need to think about. Because if we don't think about it now, we don't talk about it now, then when it does bubble up, when it does become true, it will become true in the hands of people who have terrible designs for it. And so it's very important to think about kind of what the return of the strong gods mean for us in the near future. Now, again, for Reno, this is kind of a scary thing. And he does what I think a lot of these Catholic writers do. And I'm not trying to bag on Catholic writers, because at least they're trying to address some of this stuff. You don't see a lot of evangelical writers trying to address that, though that's not as true now. You see kind of the Christian nationalism movement attempting to address these things. So credit to them. I have my own problems with some of that strategy, but it is at least a group of people who are taking this problem seriously. They recognize that these forces are returning, and we can kind of deal with that or not. But if we don't, then it's going to be handed over to bad people. So if we can focus it and channel it into something like Christianity, that's important. And that is ultimately kind of where Reno goes. He says, you know, we need to return to virtue, and we need to return to the church. And these are the things that are going to kind of bind us together. And those things are true. I agree with that stuff. But it's very clearly avoiding the most dangerous parts of this topic. It's definitely a half measure at best at looking about kind of what this means. So like I hinted at, I also want to compare this to another book that I have been reading a lot recently, which is Samuel Huntington's The Clash of Civilizations. Now, many of you probably already know this, but for those who don't, Samuel Huntington was a professor. I think he was at Harvard, but he was the teacher of many critical people, including Francis Fukuyama, who had kind of the end of history idea. So he wrote the book about the end of history, the essay, and then the book. And same thing, Sam Huntington wrote an essay of Clash of Civilization, which became a book. And these are like two competing novels. For Francis Fukuyama was kind of betting on the kind of neoliberal vision that liberal democracy was going to conquer the world. Capitalism is going to conquer the world. This is the end of history because we've answered all of the political questions. We've answered all the economic questions, all the serious questions about how to organize society and understand social organization have already been answered. And so history's over. And from there, it's just kind of making some tweaks and figuring some things out. Fukuyama apparently had a less cartoonish version of this in the original book. I've only read the updates to it, and apparently he's only become more cartoonish. He's kind of everything. Francis Fukuyama feels a lot like Marx or Engels. You know, it's one of those guys where I'm told, oh, well, no, they didn't really, you know, their arguments are much more nuanced. You got to just read the text, and someone, you know, will show me quotes of those people, and I'll read them, and I'll say, no, that's kind of exactly what I expected. That's pretty much exactly what I believed. And Fukuyama is one of those people. Every time someone tells me, no, he's far more nuanced, there's much more to it than I read his stuff, and I'm like, not so much, actually. But anyway, the point is, Fukuyama had this idea of the end of history. And the end of history was again, the idea that we had solved all of these problems. We had arrived at all the logical conclusions when it comes to experimenting with human organization. Western liberal democracy was going to reign supreme. Capitalism was going to reign supreme. The kind of global hegemonic empire that was built on top of those things is going to continue to kind of reign in perpetuity. And it's really about working about the kinks here. Samuel Huntington thought something very different. He said, actually, what we're looking at, and he wrote this to his credit, and he wrote this in 1995, really very close to the fall of the Soviet Union, only a few years after. We don't think about that much anymore, but it's a sea change in the way that you understand international relations. And this became this kind of became the way that he saw what the post-Cold War world was going to look like. And he said, a lot of people, you know, are doing the Francis Fukuyama thing. They think, oh, well, the United States has won and capitalism now reigns supreme and democracy reigns supreme. But he says, actually, what we're going to see is a shift away from the Western liberal model. We're actually going to see a shift away from Western liberal democracy. And instead, we're going to see people revert back to civilizational blocks. So rather than have this one, this bipolar world turn into this unipolar, hegemonic, America-controlled kind of global state, instead, we're going to see a return to these civilizational blocks. Now, it looked like for a long time, Francis Fukuyama was going to be right. I mean, it looked like he was in the lead there, right? Kind of the global American empire reigned supreme, and it didn't seem like anyone could kind of destroy this juggernaut. However, as we've seen over the last few years, actually, that may not be the case. And it's looking more and more like Huntington was right. And what we saw was just kind of a decade or two of momentum off the victory over the Soviet Union that would eventually lead to this global American empire's decline. And as the decline occurs, we start to see those civilizational blocks arise. Now, for Huntington, the important part of this was really before it looked like modernization and westernization had to be the same thing. In order for a state to move out of the third world and into the first world, for it to kind of modernize it all, it had to bring in all of these aspects of Americanism and Western identity. It had to homogenize. It had to do all that globalization. However, he saw the cracks starting to form in that even back in 1995. And he said, yes, while many of these states are superficially tying themselves to the global American empire, you can start to see their desire to modernize, but make their modernization different from America, to find a way to kind of bring themselves into the current paradigm technologically and you know, with all the social advancements of in certain areas, but still retain their identity, their culture, and specifically, in his mind, religion. For Huntington, religion is the core. And that doesn't mean he doesn't acknowledge that, you know, race, ethnos, language, you know, geography, all of these things are key to the formation of identity and nation states. However, he acknowledges that perhaps the nation state is not going to be the primary thing that's going to define the geopolitical landscape, but these collection, the nation state might be too small. The we're going to have these civilizational blocks, and that a nation state will sit at the center of it. You might have one or two lead nation states inside the civilizational block, but their kind of sphere of influence will be more along religious lines. That will be the thing that kind of allows the maximal social organization across national borders, but is still smaller than a global control of an area. And so he looks at things like kind of the Western bloc, the Orthodox bloc, the Muslim bloc, the Cynic, the kind of the Chinese bloc. And so like all of these different blocs that are built around kind of religious and cultural identities rather than having kind of this end of history model. And during this, he says, okay, the really important thing to understand is that we are going to see the disillusion of these kind of purely ideological identities. You know, he said basically in the Cold War era, we had the communist the communist dictator model, right? We kind of had that the Soviet Union model, that ideology, and then we had the capitalist democratic model, and those economic ideologies replaced what had been for a very long time the more traditional forms of identity that had existed for human beings. We did not align human organization along purely ideological lines until very recently, And once those two major powers kind of stopped being these two poles in geopolitics, stopped being these two poles in international relations, it opened up the opportunity for older identities to emerge. You could still have certain capitalist frameworks or democratic frameworks, but you would see the emergence of different identities, and those would start to change those frameworks in a very particular way. And we can see that, of course, with like the communist adoption of many parts of the market economy, or the way that something like Hungary has adopted a far less liberal democratic model, even though it's probably holding on to many of kind of the more capitalist aspects of certain things. There's also, they're not afraid of certain social controls. And so we're seeing a more hybrid versions of this, and they're focused on what most nations used to be focused on, what peoples and social organizations used to be focused on, which was the betterment of the people under them, right? Rather than saying our identity is ideological, we are capitalism, or we are democracy, or we are communism, or we are authoritarianism. Instead, they say, okay, well, here's a group of people, and here's kind of the way that they live their lives. What's best for them? You know, what works for them? And let's be frank, what benefits their leaders, right? The elites tied to them that are the ones who are really making those decisions. And so Huntington expected a fracturing along these civilizational lines. And he said, the question of who are we is going to be the most important question. Who are we, right? That, he said, the civilizations that are ready to answer that question are the ones that are kind of going to succeed, are going to be able to move forward into the next century. And so who are we becomes a really important question. Now, my buddies, Daryl Cooper and Lafayette Lee, released a very interesting dialogue on IM-1776 yesterday. And the piece was talking about American ethnogenesis and the fact that America had failed at ethnogenesis multiple times, though it had approached several moments until key things like kind of the Hart-Celler Act broke it back apart. And they kind of address the topic of whether or not America could kind of get into this again, could once again attempt to forge an ethnos. Now, people get really weird around that word because most people don't have any understanding of its, historical significance. People just think in kind of crude racial terms at the moment, which is not particularly helpful. Not that those things don't have a certain level of salience, unfortunately, especially in our current society. But they don't understand kind of what an ethnogenesis would mean for the United States. The United States took many different European ethnos, during its time, and was working to forge them into one particular American version of that. And succeeded in some ways, but maybe not in others. Part of the problem was probably that America grew too quickly, just territorially. And so there was never one way of life that bound the country together for very long. That's an issue that we might get into. I'm going to have Daryl Cooper on next week. He's been on the show before. He's coming back next week. And we're going to talk about that some, along with some very other interesting topics. So I'm going to get kind of more into that. But this is definitely what we talk about when we're talking about the return of the strong gods. Because America needs to have something that allows it to understand itself. The American people do. I mean, part of that is simply stopping the flow of new people. You can't become one people until you stop the flow of new people. That's something that America just has to do. But another part of it might just be the size of America. And this might be something that occurs regionally. It might be America as a civilizational block is better formed out of many cultural, culturally Christian sub-ethnos that kind of form inside an America that breaks itself in some certain ways, a more extreme version of federalism. I'm not sure how that's going to work out, but we might get into that with Daryl next week. The point here is to say that these strong gods are very difficult. They are tumultuous for a reason. People were scared of them for a reason, rightly so, because they are the things that move men's passions and animate them to kind of give of themselves. And this is kind of the reason that you look at the American military and they can't get anyone to recruit anymore, because they've gotten rid of all the strong gods, right? We kind of coasted by on a certain level of general patriotism for a long time, but the American government, the regime, has made it very clear that it's not a big fan of many of the people who traditionally signed up for the military. A lot of the guys from Texas and Appalachia who made up the kind of front line, the combat readiness of the United States, are no longer welcome, and they can't get those guys to come back after kind of ripping that mask off and showing their face. And that's a real problem, right? You need those strong gods, or what's left of those strong gods. We had them on life support originally when it came to try to kind of keep the American military going, but it's not working anymore, right? And this is going to be a more and more of a problem for the regime that's terrified of these forces, but simultaneously needs them. But it doesn't understand that it needs them. It's still so scared. It knows it needs some aspect of what they used to produce, but it doesn't know how to get them anymore. The lions are gone. They've driven the lions away. The lions are no longer willing to protect the foxes and their empire anymore. And they don't know how to get them back because they fundamentally don't understand lions. They can't think like lions. In fact, they are repulsed by the very existence of lions, even though they know to some level they need them. They just want to be able to say, go arrest that guy or go fight that war. And they just want to be able to do that in perpetuity. And they never want to think about like what those people need, what's good for them. In fact, they want to spit on them, and they want to spurn them for a very long time. And so this is an issue that's not going away. It's not getting any less important. And like I said, we're going to talk a little bit more about it next week with Daryl Cooper. But I just wanted to bring these ideas forward because I think, like I said, R.R. Reno, while the book does not really take us to solutions, again, I feel like, you know, like books like his and Patrick Deneen's newest one, Regime Change, both of them have a similar problem in that their frames address serious problems and they bring important insights, but they're not willing to really look at anything that is a significant change. There's no real change in any of these books. There's no real attempt to address the strong gods return in any of these books. Simply acknowledgement that these forces are kind of sitting at the edge of what's going on, of the popular consciousness right now, and that they will re-enter at some point. And really, they're books that are just acknowledgements that we're just not going to talk about them, I fear. This is, again, the problem of a civilization that is terrified of truth. Is so dedicated to the removal of truth that it can't discuss anything of value, because that means those things will simply re-enter the public consciousness with no readiness, with no preparation, with no understanding. And when those forces are truly unleashed, things will get wild. Now, I understand why the left can't interact with these things, because the left's entire existence, I mean, the entire program at the left at this point is destroying every aspect of the strong gods, right? The gods must be so weak, the forces that compel men, that give people their identity, must be so weak that you can change it at a moment's notice. You can go from a man to a woman, you know, you can dye your hair and get a haircut and become polyamorous and kind of completely divest yourself from any strong ties, any real notion of who you are and what you should fight for and what you should be constrained by and what has a call to be, you know, to make you kind of compel you to certain behaviors. Now, what's interesting, and Reno points this out, and he's right to do so, is that even though the left have worked really hard to create these weak gods, of course, they still have gods, right? They're still tied to these forces. And guys, I obviously, Christ is King, you know, understand the metaphor here, but these different forces still exist for the left, and they still demand kind of sacrifice on their behalf. And so while the left has attempted to make these gods weak in many ways, they're still made themselves subject to them and completely with a very great lack of awareness on kind of what's happening there. And so I guess I want to wrap this up by saying, we're going to need to talk about this stuff. This stuff matters. The return of the strong gods is happening. And the right needs a story on this. And it needs a story that is multifaceted. I know many people have attempted to address this, and I don't have a perfect answer for this yet. I'm working on it. for sure. This is something I think a lot about. But it's very clear that the people who have attempted to dress on the right are done it in a very coarse and blunt way. And in many ways, that's because they had to, I guess. There wasn't a lot of other option. But I think there needs to be more to this. The nested reality of authority and hierarchy and identity and these other forces that are going to re-enter, that we have to understand them at multiple levels, as I think Peugeot was talking about. And we have to get more sophisticated in that understanding as we do so. Because if you just use them for like kind of as coarse, blunt instrument in politics, I think then we just look like leftists. Right. We and not because, ooh, the leftists do identity politics. Not that, but we have this kind of low resolution and cheap understanding of it. And the forces that we're talking about are things that are higher and more powerful. And we should be treating them with that reverence and understanding. And we should be putting them beyond the political in the way that makes them actually civilization sustaining, that gives them true vitality. The reason these things are powerful is because they are eternal, because they are transcendent, because they grant us access to the chain of being and something that is outside of ourselves. And if we just use them as kind of blunt political instruments, then we don't do ourselves justice. And I think ultimately we fail in the project of building something that makes us worthy of, you know, guiding civilization in a better direction. All right, guys. So that's kind of what I had to say about that. Again, if you want to go ahead and check out R.R. Arena's book, I do recommend it, even though, like I said, it does come up short a little bit. It was on my recommended reading list. And I certainly recommend Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. It's always interesting when you read two books really close to each other and you find kind of that shared overlap, lapping language and understanding of a problem, even though they were written several decades apart. I always find that interesting. I think that gives you a look at things from different angles. Again, if you kind of read this in tandem also with Carl Schmitt, you get the metaphysical and the political next to each other, which I think is a really interesting way to view this. All right, I'm going to switch over to the questions of the people here real quick. We've got Adam E. who says, congrats on the book launch. Can't wait to read it. Again, thank you guys. I really appreciate it. It's been so wild. And I did not imagine just a few years ago being in this position. So having this this level of support and everything is just amazing. And I can't thank you guys enough. I wouldn't have been able to do this without you. And I have the best audience. There's really all I can say about that. Tor McCabe says, is asking what does democracy mean existing in your opponent's frame, like saying Democrats are the real racists. Another possible frame, different democracies for different people. I understand what you say here. Torin is pointing to the fact that I ask what does democracy mean in this sentence. That's something I post on Twitter. To be fair, I post like, what does this thing mean? And specific words when it's obvious. What I'm pointing out when I point that out to people is actually I'm actually attempting to break that frame, because what I'm trying to say is obviously the word we're using here has lost all meaning. It has become a magical word. And so I want you to think about what that word is being filled with. That word has become a shibboleth. It's been imbued with certain meaning. What meaning is that, right? I'm certainly not asking people to think more about democracy or to support democracy. And I'm not sure that different democracies for different peoples really communicates that. Democracy is not a universal solution. That's actually kind of the point here. History is not over, right? These questions are still ongoing. Different peoples have different social organizations and forms of government for a reason. I agree with Joseph de Maistre about this, that there is a correct form of government, but it is for each people. That's a question that's specific to the people, not to humanity as a whole. And so the question is really just there to mainly break people out of this frame of thinking that democracy is this universal good and this universal word that applies to everyone, and instead make it clear that different people actually do want different ways of organizing, and it's okay to ask that question. But thank you for that. Perspicacious Heretic says, to keep a coherent society, do we need an external common enemy like the USSR has to unify around, or is a positive vision of your own culture enough? And the answer is both. You do. So the concept of the political, you know, the point of the friend enemy distinction is the ability to declare that which is outside, other, that which that the body politic can be unified against. And so every civilization, where we whether we like it or not, does need an external common enemy. That's something that people aren't going to like to hear, but tough. We're not here to tell people what they want to hear. We're just going to tell them the truth. And so I think that's true. That doesn't mean you need to go out and manufacture one. I think if we were more honest and understood our situation a little more, we would find plenty. We don't have a dearth of enemies. That's not really the issue. That said, you also need a positive vision. You need to understand who you are to understand who even opposes that. And so you need to have a positive vision, a moral vision that unifies you towards a common good. You cannot practice virtue. You cannot become more virtuous until you have a shared language and understanding of what is best inside your community and what that community is and how you can work towards the betterment of it. And so that will naturally bring you to conclude that certain kind of external common enemies exist. But I think you first need a vision of who you are. I don't think that a common enemy is enough. And if you have any doubt about that, look at the right now, right? I think we know we have a common enemy. If nothing else, I mean, we may have different degrees of how much they're the enemy, but I think, you know, the conservative or right as it stands now is really just a collection of people who don't like the left. And that's not enough to actually create a community. We've seen that multiple times. And so I think that you do need a more substantive version of that if you're going to stand together and have a coherent society. But the answer is you certainly need both if you know you're going to have one. But I think that the former will arise very easily, especially after you have the latter. Simpler, sorry, I know there's some way to pronounce that and I'll get it wrong probably forever. But he says, personally, I think connecting the atomized, sensitive young man to their heritage, even so far as to look at the pagan gods as really ancestor kings whose blood is yours and whose deeds are yours to repeat, is a route. I mean, you certainly need to connect people to their history, to their shared values, the shared traditions, folkways, understandings. Religion, of course, is critical to that. It's probably the most critical portion of that. Again, if you want to understand that, I would encourage people to read The Ancient City. It's an amazing book for a lot of reasons, but explaining this is one of them. Does that mean we need to connect ourselves to pagan gods? No, I don't think so. For most people, Christianity is the history that has bound people together. I know there's a desire in certain corners to say, well, that's where everything went off the rails. Guys, Christianity has been the dominant religion of most of your societies for like at least 1500 years. And so everything that you like about your society, everything about your shared identity is founded inside of it. It's not perfect. Nothing is. Paganism failed for certain reasons. It gave way to certain things. Christianity has failure points. It has the areas in which it is weak. It gives birth to certain things, and progressivism is absolutely one of them. But as I think, you know, Spengler correctly pointed out, each civilization has its atheistic mirror to its religion, and he did not exempt pagan religions from this. He said that they enter into these phases just as regularly as Christianity does. I think it's easy to stare at the current Christian version of that and say, therefore Christianity is bad or wrong or the problem. But no, that's just it's inverse reflection to your society. I think you've misdiagnosed the problem with your society if you feel like Christianity is the problem with your society. I think you don't understand cyclical history properly. And I would just encourage you to think on that some more. However, it is certainly true that there are stories from pagan societies, from ancient societies that are in ways part of our heritage. And there's a lot of value looking at them, understanding that they're not valuable because they're pagan necessarily, but they're valuable because they're part of our heritage. And if that does, you know, if that is part of your tradition, that does draw you towards virtue, that's good. But remember that religion and virtue are lived things. And unless you're in a community where you can practice these things, they don't really persist. And so it's nice if you manage to get together and like have that by yourself or something, but you're not really in a situation where you can build that and turn it into something that you can pass on without that community. And so I would encourage you to find that in your most recent traditions, if possible. Though that doesn't mean that there isn't, of course, powerful figures from our past that can inform that as well. Let's see here. Follows up with Christ is still king and the foundation to build on. Of course. Yes, sir. Absolutely correct. Again, there's nothing wrong with looking to those ancient stories. I mean, there's still incredible power to be found in them. Those archetypes are real for a reason. They echo through time for a reason. They do touch on the eternal, and they're recognized for a reason. But of course, I think Christ is more the fulfillment of those things, and so I think that's important. RCW here says, "Well, you're great. Well, thank you, man. I very much appreciate it. I'm glad you're around and joining the show, and I really appreciate your guys' support." Trey 50 Daniel says, "In essence, this can be summed up: you must have a fully formed positive vision of your past, present, and future that will benefit a people." Correct? Yes, yes. Though I would say these are, of course, ongoing projects, right? It's not just we build this, you know, we build this identity, we build this fully formed positive vision, past, present, and future, and then all of this stuff falls into place. I don't think it's that. That's the causal flow. We have to start thinking about ways of being, right? We have to start understanding that our epistemology cannot simply be reason. We cannot simply plan everything out in advance. We can't simply quantify everything and chart it out in the way it would go and then follow that plan. Instead, we have to understand that like our knowledge, our traditions, these things will be built in the way that we live our lives, in our ways of being. And we have to find more meaningful ways of being. I know that sounds kind of woo-woo, but the point is here that there is just a lot of truth to the fact that there is knowledge and history and tradition wrapped up in the way that you live life. And so these things will arise because we think about them and we reason about them and we talk about them and share about them. But they'll also be true because we live them out in patterns, and those patterns build on each other, and they build our identities, and they build our traditions, and they connect us to the transcendent. And once that kind of right ordered being is created, then I think a lot of the stuff flows far more easily. The problem right now is we are so disaffected, we're so modern, we're so atomized that we can't even think about how this stuff could happen. And that's why LARPing is so important. Okay. People who tell you, "Oh, that's LARPing, that's fake, you're what?" Garbage. These people are wrong. Garbage. Do it. Go out and do it. Meet the people, make friends, build community, serve people, work out, practice virtue, praise God. Okay. Do these things, do them, even if you don't mean them, even if it feels weird, even if it feels disingenuous, do them. Do the things. Take the steps. Be that person, okay? You have to be that person before those things are real. It's not that they're real. It's not that they're fake. It's not that they're a lie. It's simply that you're so cut off from what those things could be that your rational brain cannot address them. Well, guess what? It's never going to start if you don't start. So take the steps, guys. Take the steps. That's the most important advice I can give you. You gotta clean up your room. Jordan Peterson's right about that. Once you start doing those things, once you start living those truths, they will become more real to you. And that sounds like garbage until you do it, and then you realize it's absolutely correct. All right, guys, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap it up here. Thank you everyone for coming by. It's been great talking to you. Appreciate the audience so much. Again, if you'd like to join and kind of pre-order the book, the link to do that is down below in the description. If you'd like to go ahead and subscribe to this channel, make sure that you go ahead and click the subscribe button. Please make sure you click on the notifications, guys. Again, when I go live, if you don't have the notifications on, you don't know, and then you miss the hangout, and you don't, you know, the it's fun to listen to these later on, but it's more fun to be part of the conversation. Now, of course, if you'd like to listen to these broadcasts as podcasts, you can go ahead and subscribe to the Orin McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. And when you do, leave the rating, leave the review, give it that 5-star, guys. It helps with the algorithm, spreads the word. Really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, once more for coming by and for all the support. And as always, I will talk to you next time.